Support comes from the Amistad Center for Art and Culture. They inspire, entertain, and educate through art, cultural, and educational programs and events. Join them to celebrate Juneteenth 2024. It's a new day. Learn more at amistadcenter.org.
My name is Pat Wilson Phineas, and I am the ninth generation descendant of Montrose and Phyllis. Flora would have been my fifth great-grandmother. The poem, Grandma Flora, it was just sort of like an open letter, because I said to myself, what would I say to this woman if I, you know, I had actually been to Highland House and walked around in her footsteps? But I'll just read it. You were lost to me, but now you are found just now in the scheme of time. I have not always known you, but still love abounds. Family loves like that. It seeks to surround. We all have lives. We all came from somewhere. We all own this country. We all built it. It's just that some of us have been left out, and the history that we've learned is only one small slice of the pie that makes America great.
From Connecticut Public, this is Unforgotten, Connecticut's Hidden History of Slavery. I'm Diane Orson.
And I'm Frank Mitchell.
When we think of slavery in the U.S., we don't often think of the North.
Enslavement happened here and has deep roots in Connecticut and across New England.
In this series, we'll hear stories about recovering this history.
And we talk about some of the issues in and around these stories.
In the second story in our series, we'll hear more from Pat Wilson Phineas. But first, Frank, let's talk about the lives of enslaved people in Connecticut. What did slavery look like in Connecticut? How did it compare, say, with our understanding of slavery in the South?
We have these notions of what slavery looked like, mostly because of what we learned about the South. And there are so many examples that challenge or dispute people's expectations of what slavery was like. In Connecticut and in New England, people did the same jobs that other working people were doing, farming, building stone walls. We have a couple accounts from Venture Smith or James Mars in which they talk about what their days were like and the kinds of work that they did. And it really was the kind of work that you could imagine needing to be done in colonial Connecticut, unless you were in the city where you were doing more domestic chores to keep a fancy or middle-class home going. But even a lot of those folks were doing the kind of farm work that was necessary in Connecticut because of what we were exporting as a state. As people begin to move into freedom, we get different accounts of their ingenuity and the kind of creativity and the kinds of ways that they are putting the skills that they had learned while they were enslaved to use in freedom to build their own lives. But you know, people did pretty much all the jobs you could imagine. And in account books and other people's diaries and ledgers and wills, you get a sense of what life was like. And we do have these really unique examples. I think about Fortune, the enslaved man in Waterbury who became a teaching skeleton. And ended up in the Mattituck Museum.
Hold on. You need to explain that. What do you mean he became a teaching skeleton?
He died, and the enslaver turned him into a teaching skeleton, and he hoped to have a medical college in Waterbury. And so the bones moved across generations and then finally ended up in the collection of the Mattituck Museum, where they were on view for a while. And at that point, Fortune was known as Larry the Skeleton. And was a museum exhibit, a beloved museum exhibit. And at a certain point, he went off view, and a research project began in the 90s to track down this history. And it was kind of incredible because there was so much you could learn from those bones, despite the fact that you know they were over a century old. But there was a lot that was still in them that could be gleaned through lots and lots of research. And the skeleton went to Washington, D.C., to Howard University, where other skeletons that had been found at the African burial ground were. And students got to do work on those bones there, which was kind of incredible. So in sort of what they learned from that skeleton, we got a sense of the kind of hard work that he did, the repetitive nature of that work, probably some abuse that he suffered. There was clearly a sense from the body and from the bones of the life of somebody who would have been, you know, the man working to maintain a farm while Preserve Porter, the doctor or the would-be doctor, was trying to build this medical practice.
Whoa. My sense is that slavery in the North was the same institution as slavery in the South, but the scale was smaller. We didn't have plantations with hundreds of people on them. Am I right about that?
Yeah, there were far fewer big farms like that in Connecticut, certainly. I mean, there were a few places where there were multiple families enslaved doing farming work, but most people were living in a household, doing all the chores that needed to be done, they and their family. So Fortune had a family that lived with him at Preserve Porter's. Actually, they had their own little spot nearby. And that's certainly true. That was true for James Mars. You think about Bristol around West Hartford. He had a spot of his own and then goes on to have land. So
you're naming, enslaved people who told their stories.
Yeah, who told their stories or whose stories we've been able to figure out bits and pieces of thanks to records and court testimony or things like that, who appear in documents. If they aren't telling their own story, they show up somehow in public documents and give us a glimpse of what their lives were like.
Okay, we'll talk more when we return. Let's listen now. In the U.S., we tend to think of slavery as a Southern thing. I recently met with Pat Wilson Phineas, who remembers spending a lot of her childhood in Connecticut trying not to be noticed.
Because in Ashford, Connecticut, which is where I grew up, it was an all-white town except for us. I remember studying every year, it seemed like the Civil War would come up and there would be pictures, and that was me. That was the representation of me to my classmates. I was the living slave. I did not have a context for understanding the richness of my history.
A phone call one day changed that. Wilson Phineas, a former Connecticut state representative, was running for elected office at the time.
I was home from door knocking one day and sitting on the back porch, and my husband came out with this odd look on his face, and he said, "There's a man on the phone that knows a bit too much about you, and I want you to talk to him." And so I was like, "Well, what?" So I took the phone, and it turned out to be a middle school teacher from Guilford who was so excited. And he was giving me all of this information about people that I had no knowledge of.
The teacher, a local librarian, and others were researching the history of slavery in Guilford. They'd read through early court records, journals, and personal papers, and found documents about her ancestors.
We were equally excited because I was like the literal living end to years of his research, and he gave me a family I didn't know that I had.
We're about a block away from the town green in Guilford, a small community along coastal Connecticut. All around us are historic homes and businesses. Wilson Phineas and I are sitting in a quaint saltbox-style house built in 1713, the Highland House Museum. Her family is intimately connected to this space.
Highland House is where my aunt Candace lived for about 20 years. She is a part of this house, and when I walk around here, I feel her. I connect to her.
Candace was born in 1751, the youngest daughter in a family who were enslaved to a merchant living on the town green. Enslaved people were often assigned first names and not given last ones. Each child in the family was indentured out to neighbors when they were about 20 years old. Candace was indentured for life to the people who lived here.
Candace was both enslaved and indentured for 12 pounds a year. Each of the children was rented out, in effect. So she was rented, if you will, but it was sort of like a life rental.
We're in the dining room where Candace once worked. There's a fireplace and nearby pantry. Wilson Phineas explains that she's a ninth-generation descendant of Candace's enslaved parents, Montrose and Phyllis, who were captured from Africa.
Montrose and Phyllis were two enslaved teenagers who were brought to Guilford by David Naughty in 1727. They were imported, which I thought was an odd word, but it turned out that that simply meant he avoided paying taxes because they came in through Boston and he was bringing them to Guilford. But he purchased two teenagers who didn't know each other. The two came over on two different ships, two different ship captains. 3 years later, they were married and began to have children. Naughty died only about 10 years after bringing the two teenagers to his home. He left a will when he died, and in that will, he freed Montrose and Phyllis and their children. They were to be freed, however, after Mrs. Naughty died, and she lived for 30 more years. Mm-hmm. So they were promised freedom, but they didn't all obtain it.
With us in the dining room is Wilson Phineas' son, Cheo Hodari Coker.
These are our ancestors. But the mm-hmm. fact that they were property, the fact that they were traded and loaned out like furniture or cars, but in a place in Connecticut, in the north. And so when it comes to Connecticut, were you at all surprised?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it's the fact that I could grow up here in an educated community and all of the, you know, the schools that you would expect that you learn whatever you needed to learn. And I learned nothing of myself. I learned nothing about, enslavement in the Northeast. I certainly had no idea that I had generations of ancestors going back to 1727.
Montrose was freed in 1772 after the death of David Naughty's wife, Ruth. Phyllis died while she was still enslaved. In her will, Ruth Naughty indentured all of their children for life. She said it would be, in her words, much better for them to live in some good, regular, and religious families as servants than to enjoy freedom. Only Candace would live long enough to be emancipated. She married, worked as a spinner and baker, and died in 1826. Future generations of this family would include a Revolutionary War soldier, a World War I machinist, a World War II Tuskegee airman who was awarded a Bronze Star, as well as Wilson Phineas, who served as state commissioner of the Department of Social Services, and Coker, a writer and producer known for the TV series Luke Cage and the film Notorious. I ask what finding this history has meant to them.
Finding that history gave me a sense of ownership and a sense of belonging that, you know, I wish I hadn't had to wait till I was Social Security age to come to believe that I was really an American.
When you're able to look back at your lineage and understand that you have relatives that were not only in Revolutionary War, but in virtually every single American conflict, mm-hmm. then you think differently about patriotism. Mm-hmm. Now that we understand who it is we are and what do we do with this and what's the importance of knowing who you are, it shouldn't be just shame and anger. Mm-hmm. It also should be a sense of ownership that this is my country as well.
That piece is incredible. It is amazing to hear her talk about being the only one in her classroom and sitting through the lessons of the Civil War and feeling so obvious and exposed. And I am grateful that she has a different understanding of history right now. And I know there are other folks out there who have had the same experience, particularly in courses around the Civil War and feeling as though they are the only one and they're exposed in a way they don't want to be and possibly humiliated. Even as we struggle in this country to think about now how students feel called out who are not descendants of enslaved Black people in history courses and in thinking about the Civil War. So it's great to have her voice talking about that from that perspective.
You're Frank Mitchell. You work in the public humanities and you're editorial consultant for this series. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the tools available for people who want to learn more about their family history.
Yeah, there's so much more in 2024 that's available to us to tell these stories locally in what's been pulled out at the State Library and archives around Connecticut and the continuing investment in trying to tell these stories, as well as digitally and nationally. There are a number of great databases that track enslaved individuals around this country and around the world, actually, and researchers that are doing that work every minute somewhere. So a lot more resources that are online for tracking your family. And sort of the big pay sites have done a lot more to help tell those stories and track people down. And every second day you meet somebody who has sent some of their DNA off to learn more about who they were, who, and how it either affirms who they thought they might be, and how they're likely to be surprised by what they find as well. So lots of paper documents that are coming online all the time, and a lot more help, a lot more experienced people who have done some of this work who can guide you. And some of those folks are in our state libraries, in our historical organizations and public humanity sites. And so the familiarity with and the enthusiasm for telling these stories and helping to guide people who want to know more is at a much more sophisticated level than, you know, even 10, 15 years ago.
There must be some tricky ethical issues around things like DNA research. Could you just touch on some of that?
Yeah, I think the ethics questions of all of this are really profound and fascinating and underexplored. I was struck by sort of the tone in her voice when she said, my husband said, there's somebody on the phone who knows a lot about your family that he probably shouldn't know. You should talk to him. And what it means to have someone have this history and be an expert in your story when it's not you. And when we have the right to share that with people, when we should pause, and all those kinds of questions are questions that we're just beginning to think through and discuss and puzzle around who gets to make that decision and that call, and who do we consult before we go into someone's lives with this knowledge. And
I mean, luckily in her case, she told me this was the greatest gift of her life. But I can imagine that there are very tricky ethical questions around that.
Exactly. I mean, and often it's totally welcome, but sometimes it's not going to be.
Let's just talk for a minute about the passing on of family stories and family histories. For a lot of people, it's just talking to your great-grandmother or something. You know, when people want to explore their family history, where do you tell them to begin?
I do suggest that they think about talking to family members. It is the best way to build that kind of excitement and enthusiasm. And I think more and more people are doing that, like thinking about what do we have right around us. And certainly as I work with folks around building exhibitions, trying hard to source things that are in family collections, encouraging people to go look at old photographs, thinking about documents, thinking about census records, thinking about what's out there that you can easily put your hands on is the first step, partly because it really does, in many cases, build a lot of enthusiasm for the work that's a little harder to do. And if you are excited about what's nearby, you're willing to spend the time hunting for things that where you might have not as much success, or find something that's as exciting as you did in those conversations or in looking at those pictures or in discovering that thing in somebody in a cousin twice removed's basement.
You know, I was really quite taken by what both Pat and her son Cheo said about this feeling of belonging and how learning more about their family helped them feel that they were entitled to feel that they were part of America's history, part of Connecticut history, part of this nation.
Yeah, you want to feel as though you don't need that permission, but it's really nice to feel like the story goes back multiple generations and that there are those milestones that can be claimed. And to know that you have this connection to the state's history that moves in many cases beyond enslavement or after enslavement, there are other things that happen in your family that you can track to the present. And so many folks don't have that. So once you realize that you do have it, it is kind of incredible.
It's meaningful.
Yeah.
Okay, let's listen now to the poem that Pat Wilson Phineas wrote to her fifth great-grandmother, Flora. She describes it as an open letter.
You were lost to me, but now you are found just now in the scheme of time. I have not always known you, but still love abounds. Family loves like that. It seeks to surround. I never felt your pain, but I remember it. You never knew freedom. You never knew a whole life. You had 6 short years to watch your only child grow. He'd live in freedom to father generations, but you could not know. Or did you see? Have you always been there, just waiting for me? Can it be that you've already known not just what was stolen, but how we have grown? Did you watch young Caesar Nigro become all that he could be? Were you there when he got the name of those who held him and chose to set him free? Caesar Nigro to Caesar Hill. Yes, progress, but yet and still, ownership is not kinship, and kinship was his will. When free, he took his father's name, and Caesar Rogers he became. How Grandpa Sharper must have glowed. Kinship claimed would lift a heavy load. Rogers, our very first family name, allowed us to fend off some of the shame. Claiming it took agency, stamina, and skill. With knowledge of that struggle, I'll honor it. I will. Grandma Flora, did you know that Caesar named his first daughter after you and his second son after your lost brother Abel? Were you there when Abel's daughter Sylvia took a husband and changed again our family's name? Rogers to Wilson, another proud game. Sylvia's son was Alexander. Did you fear his leave from Guilford with only a fishmonger's skill? How proud were you in Virginia when education let him teach at will? Alexander's son William was a teacher too. His son and his grandson both excelled in school. 2 Bertram Wadsworths, a man and his junior. Senior, honored with a science lab after 50 years, he was dubbed the best machinist Goucher College ever had. His son, a fighter pilot, was also my dad. Yes, indeedy, isn't it grand? Your 4th great-grandson flew skies in 3 wars to protect this American land. Were you with him at Tuskegee when he earned his wings? Were you with him in the cockpit doing valiant things? Were you there as he dodged hot enemy metal, earning the Distinguished Flying Cross and Bronze Stars for his valor? Did you watch over him and keep him safe and strong in Korean fields and in the swamps of Vietnam? Were you there to comfort when home from the war, yet again, he faced cruel disdain? Grandmommy, did you know that the sons of all your sons fought in every great war to defend? Did you hope that bravery and valiant service would cure America's hate of our skin? It didn't. Grandma Flora, now I'm a grandmother too. And through these years of struggle, I've lived the things you could not do. You had no early schooling. You never learned to read. The law did not protect you or your precious seed. But now I am a lawyer with 2 advanced degrees. I can right wrongs and help folks get the things they need. And I will tell our story of America to children who can take heed. You never earned money. Me, more than needed to pay my bills. You could never, ever vote, but I always, always will. No one called you Miss or Ma'am, and that is such a shame. But when my presence is now announced, the Honorable precedes my name. No one believed that you could think or cared how you might feel. No one needed to respect you or to judge your value real. Your body must have ached all day. You couldn't rest without someone's say. The good of your work was not yours for pay. You could not reap fruits from the ground you'd plowed. So very little time to live the life you were allowed. For you, there were endless don'ts and can'ts, your future dulled by 1,000 shants. Knowing that your blood courses through my veins, I will concede not ever. Your legacy helps me to embrace your life and times forever. Family love is like that. Grandmommy, thank you for choosing life and for bringing forth the one we all sprang from. I live because of you. Because I live, my son lives, and his children will live to grow a foundation to sustain our family for generations. I take strength from you. The hidden source of strength I've always had comes, I think, from you. Was it the warmth of your smile that I felt on my face as I rose to places that you could not grace? Was it your heart that stoked my resolve when I focused my energy a problem to solve? Was it you that pushed me, reminding with each stride, in part because of you, Black folks my age could glide. We climb the stairs you built. We taste the tears you spilt. We live the life you should have had. We still fight for our skin. And that is just sad. Yet, despite the many barriers, we still work toward the prize. We still fight to defend this land. And yes, we still rise. From every dream that you were denied, I saw dreams fulfilled. I believed, I applied. For every shackled step you took, I rose to achieve, to rewrite the book. Can you know how full the life that I control, how very strong my future? Our family suffers want no more. We've time and funds to nurture. Grandma Flora, for all the years and all the tears, for hopes that never happened, for dreams you weren't allowed to have, I'm unrestrained, path opened. We celebrate the bonds of time, the years you lived, that we survived. Family love is strong and forever. It's with us every minute. Thanks for giving me my life and for always being in it. Your fifth great-granddaughter I am, with admiration and gratitude, a proud and loving heir, witnessing your grace and sacrifice and fortitude.
Next time on Unforgotten.
My dad used to tell stories, but I didn't believe him. The way he talked about Venture was almost like he was a mythical figure. So I had been hearing about him lifting rocks and this big, strong guy. Like, I didn't really think that he was real. And then as we got older, we started coming here.
Thanks for listening. I'm reporter-producer Diane Orson. Frank Mitchell is our consulting editor. Eric Austin is our executive editor. The senior director of storytelling is Katie Tolarski, and Cassandra Basler is our podcast producer. Editing help from Patrick Scahill, Erica McIntosh, and Meg Dalton. Special thanks to Julianne Veracci, senior director of visuals. A big shout out to our social, visuals, and marketing teams for their support. Vanessa De La Torre is our chief content officer. Our theme music is The Pleasures of Solitude from a manuscript with compositions by Sonny Freeman. Visit ctpublic.org/unforgotten to learn more about the project, including more photos and videos. Unforgotten is a production of Connecticut Public.